it, and some of the people were trying to climb the wall to escape this devastating attack.
It's being said that many of those who came here yesterday were from the city's Christian minority community, who'd come because it was Easter Sunday. The city is continuing to go about its business. However, it is more subdued than normal. The authorities have declared 3 days of mourning, so that means many shops and businesses are closed. We've come along to the Sheikh Zayed Hospital in Lahore. It's the nearest hospital to the park where the bomb went off. So a number of the injured were brought here immediately afterwards. The hospital authorities have pinned up a list of those being treated inside for their injuries. It gives their name and their age and their gender, and it's quite revealing. There's a 5-year-old girl, a 7-year-old boy, an 11-year-old boy, a 2-year-old boy. There are 14 kids on this list who have been treated for injuries, and this is just one of the city's hospitals. So it's very clear that children have been particularly hard hit in this attack.
And Phil, let me just ask you here, Pakistan is an overwhelmingly Muslim nation. How many Christians are there?
Well, they form a very small minority of Pakistan's 200 million or so population, but they have been targeted over the years for attacks. In 2013, for example, in Peshawar, 80 people were killed in a church bombing. And a year ago, right here in Lahore, more than 20 people died when two churches were bombed. I spoke with Joseph Francis, who's a leading representative of this city's Christian community. Francis says it's not clear how many Christians were among the hundreds of dead or injured in yesterday's attack, but he's in no doubt this was an attack on Christians. He was at home when he heard about the bombing.
We were sitting in front of television and thanking God that the day had passed by peacefully, and suddenly we heard about this news. At once it occurred to my mind it must have been an attack on Christians. Anybody who happens to see these scenes, he must get furious, no matter whether he is Hindu, Muslim, Christians.
Now, since mid-2014, Pakistan's armed forces have been carrying out a major and almost completely unreported war against Islamist militants. The focus of this is the tribal belt bordering Afghanistan, although the security forces also carried out a big crackdown in the city of Karachi. And this gained momentum after the Taliban bombed a school and slaughtered more than 130 boys. The army operation has meant that militant attacks have gone down in number. And the public mood also changed, says Ahmad Jan, a university lecturer who is from Lahore.
There was this feeling that perhaps suicide bombings will become a thing of the past. But I think it's hit us home last night that the war is very much an ongoing effort, and who knows whether we're winning or losing this war.
Is it your sense then, or was it the sense of people here, that the Pakistani army's efforts to crush the Taliban and other militant groups have failed?
Well, for the past a year and a half, there's been very little public debate on the military operation. There's been a lot of outpouring of support for the military. But now serious questions are being asked. Clearly, it's a taboo topic to criticize the military right now, but we need results. Right now, unfortunately, because of the censorship created by the war, there's very little public discussion, but that does not mean there's not a lot of anger amongst the public.
So, Rene, you can see that the mood here is grim.
And that's NPR's Phil Reeves reporting from Lahore, Pakistan. Phil, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Later this spring, the Marines will begin training the first women for ground combat jobs, although it's unclear how many women will even be there to take the training, because so far, no women have signed up for armor, artillery, or infantry positions. That includes the more than 200 female Marines who completed ground combat training as part of an experiment. NPR's Tom Bowman tried to find out why so few women are signing up to go the distance.
It was just a year ago that Captain Ray Castor was leading his infantry company during training in the Mojave Desert. Male and female Marines ran across the sand, shooting at pop-up targets, all part of the effort to see if women can make it in the unforgiving world of ground combat, living in the dirt, carrying a pack weighing more than 100 pounds. Already, the physical demands have cost Castor about half of the women in his company.
Majority of those were injuries.
What kind? Shin splints?
It's the same stuff, hips. Hips and legs. More fractures, I would say.
Since then, Defense Secretary Ash Carter opened armor, artillery, and infantry jobs to women, even though the Marine Corps wanted to keep those infantry jobs closed. The women in the experiment, the Marine leadership said, did not perform as well as the men. So I reached out to Captain Castor, a combat veteran, at his base, Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, for his thoughts about the future with women in ground combat.
I don't think that there's going to be a giant rush of soon-to-be female Marines or current female Marines that want to be in the infantry. It is a very difficult way of life. It is not a job. It is a lifestyle. It is who you are. It's what you do.
Around 100 women Marines made it through that nearly year-long Marine experiment with Captain Castor and others. It included desert and mountain training. Some women trained in artillery, others in tanks or infantry. And another 100 or so current women Marines went through basic infantry training at Camp Lejeune.
There are absolutely female Marines out there that could do the job. The concern that I have as a leader is how long can that be sustained? Because as you know, what we saw was that the injury rates were very high.
So far, not one of those women Marines has stepped forward for a career move to artillery, infantry, or armored vehicles. Brigadier General James Glynn, a Marine Corps spokesman, said he suspects they want to stay in their current Marine jobs, like driving trucks or refueling helicopters.
What we've learned from talking to some of them is it doesn't mean that there aren't intentions to do so. There's a matter of it, where does it fit? Where are you in your career, and where does it fit inside of your career?
And Colonel Ann Weinberg, who took part in the training effort, says she still expects recruits to step forward.
What's really going to be telling is, you know, the civilian females coming in and wanting to be into those ground combat arms. That's what's really going to be telling, I think.
The Marines are reaching out to those civilians who signed enlistment contracts, telling them they can now go into combat arms. So far, not a bite. Still, the Pentagon estimates that 200 women will sign up each year for Marine ground combat jobs. In the meantime, the Marines are preparing for women in those combat ranks. They're starting to send women sergeants and officers to ground combat units to work in support jobs like logistics or intelligence. Colonel Weinberg said women leaders in those jobs will serve as mentors to women recruits. They'll also send a subtle message to male Marines.
And acculturating the males to seeing that there's a competent female that is doing her job and she's hanging with us and she's out there in the field with us just like every other male.
And the Marines are coming up with better physical training for women so they don't wash out with shin splints or fractures. Captain Castor has some recommendations on that. Pull-ups and hiking with a 60-pound pack. Tom Bowman, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 8:18 on this Monday. Thanks for being with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have the latest news coming up next from NPR and WPR. Hear from survivors of World War II Japanese-American internment camps and their thoughts on the presidential campaign. More on that story from WPR's Glenn Moberg in a couple minutes.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies in the circle of life. They believe that every detail counts and every memory matters. Piasecki Althaus is located in Kenosha on 39th Avenue, serving the community since 1931.
Oddball comedies and moving dramas. WPR is pleased to support film festivals in Wisconsin. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A Taliban splinter group is claiming responsibility for an Easter Sunday suicide bombing in Pakistan. It left 70 people dead and more than 300 wounded. The bomber blew himself up in a park in Lahore. The group says it was targeting Christians and sending a message to Pakistan's military for its operations in tribal regions of the country. Tariq Fatemi is an advisor to Pakistan's prime minister, speaking to the BBC.
This is an evil that is not merely affecting one country or one society, but is affecting entire humanity.
In Belgium today, the death toll has risen to 35 following last week's ISIS attacks in Brussels. Another four people died from injuries suffered in that attack. The three attackers also died. Wisconsin is next up for the presidential candidates. Chuck Quirnbach with Wisconsin Public Radio says the state's Republican and Democratic primaries are a week from tomorrow.
Democrat Hillary Clinton has announced five stops in Wisconsin over the next 2 days. Her opponent Bernie Sanders already spoke at a rally in Madison and plans four more events in the state. The GOP contest will be lively, too. Ted Cruz and John Kasich are expected in several cities. And Donald Trump arrives in Wisconsin tomorrow for at least 2 days here.
And Wall Street futures are higher ahead of the open. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. Central Wisconsin school history program, A Walk in Their Shoes, took a political turn this past week when survivors of World War II Japanese-American internment camps warned students about this year's presidential campaign. Glenn Moberg reports.
After Pearl Harbor, our father was picked up by the FBI.
Tetsuro Akawa and Howard Zenimura, now in their late 80s, told packed school assemblies in Wausau and Edgar how they and their families were stripped of their possessions and sent to an internment camp in Gila River, Arizona. They shared the stage with historian Kariyo Nakagawa, whose family was imprisoned before he was born.
History hasn't changed, only the names have. We have political leaders today that are willing to put immigrants into concentration camps again. And if that's the case, history will repeat itself. And what lessons have we learned?
The three speakers said they were concerned about Donald Trump, who has pointed to the internment camps as examples of what America has done for national security in the past. Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
The indefinite closure of the Menasha Lock has some local residents worried that decreased boat traffic will mean decreased business. The Appleton Post-Crescent Media reports that about 9,600 boats and nearly 37,000 passengers have traveled through the lock in the last 5 years. In September, the Wisconsin DNR closed the lock temporarily to keep the round gobies, an invasive species, from reaching a lake.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Home Instead Senior Care, providing an individualized approach designed to meet a family's needs, offering a range of in-home care services from help around the house to Alzheimer's care to keep aging loved ones at home. HomeInstead.com/NPR. From the Siebel Energy Institute, supporting scientific research to increase the safety, reliability, security, and lower the environmental impact of energy production, delivery, and consumption. More at SiebelEnergyInstitute.org. And from the Economic Development Authority of Fairfax County, Virginia, committed to using the power of ideas to inspire women, minority, and veteran-owned companies. Details at powerofideas.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The nation's struggle with opioid addiction is producing babies born to mothers who can't quit. Some people in the medical community want to focus on those mothers while they're pregnant. Here's the third in our series about babies born dependent on opioids. Today, in your health, I'm joined by WCPN's Sarah Jane Tribble in Cleveland, Ohio. She spent time with a mother who wanted to quit after discovering she was pregnant. Welcome.
Good to be here, Renee.
We know that the number of people dependent on opioids is increasing, and that does include lots of women of childbearing age. Researchers estimated that by 2012, a baby was born every 25 minutes dependent. And you've gotten to know this mother and her baby. Tell us more about that.
I met Amanda Hensley about 3 months after her baby Valencia was born. She's part of a mom's program at Cleveland's big safety net hospital, MetroHealth. Amanda is 25 years old and began abusing prescription painkillers in her teens. For years, she held down jobs and even stopped for a bit when her now 4-year-old son came along. But by the time she discovered she was unexpectedly pregnant last year, she couldn't quit.
It was just one thing after another. You know, I was sick with morning sickness, and then I was also sick from using. So it was either, you know, I was puking from morning sickness or I was puking from being high. I mean, which was kind of, that's kind of how I was able to hide it for a while.
Amanda told me that she was ashamed and hurt, and she wanted to stop but didn't know how. She even had friends who would help her find the drugs after they found out she was pregnant.
And what exactly were the drugs that her friends were finding her and giving her to take?
Now, she told me that she preferred Percocet and morphine, but she would opt for heroin when she was short on cash.
So the baby's arrived. You met her after the baby was born. How is she coping?
Well, Amanda hasn't abused opioids in 9 months, and Valencia is now about 6 months old. When I visited recently, Valencia kept cooing and smiling, especially when her mother was nearby.
Mama, she started saying mama. So now at night when she wakes up, that's what I hear. Ma.
Amanda says only within the past few months has she stopped having using dreams. She and Valencia now live with the baby's father, Terrell Shepherd, but he wasn't happy when he realized Hensley was taking opioids while pregnant.
If you don't care about yourself, have enough common decency to care about the baby you're carrying. Like, be an adult, own up to what it is you're doing, and take care of business.
When we talked, Amanda was looking back on when she was pregnant, and she recalled that when she was nearly 6 months pregnant, it was a really tough time. She was living on couches, estranged from her son, her mother, and her boyfriend, Tyrell. That's when she reached out for help. One moment she dialed to get her fix, the next she called hospitals and clinics.
Nobody wants to touch a pregnant woman with an addiction issue.
As it turned out, she was rejected by two hospitals she called and several clinics. Amanda then let herself go into withdrawal and went to MetroHealth's emergency department. The hospital used a state-supported program, and staff members prescribed Subutex, an opioid replacement drug. And when Valencia was born, mom and baby had their own room. Nurses encouraged snuggling and breastfeeding, and they were on hand to drop liquid morphine into Valencia's mouth when the baby's legs started shaking and her screams turned frantically high-pitched because she, the baby, was going into withdrawal.
She wouldn't latch on. We couldn't get her to feed. I couldn't get her to stop crying. You know, she was very fussy. And I realized, you know, I did that to her. Like, I took her choice away. And that's one thing that I need to work through because I still haven't forgiven myself for that.
Just listening to this family's story, clearly it's difficult to overcome opioid addiction, even when you want to. And as we've heard before, detox just isn't enough.
That's right. It really takes a sort of medical team effort to help a pregnant woman and her baby. The problem I learned while reporting this story is that it's really difficult for women to find help.
Exactly. Is there a standard for the type of help mothers to be should get?
So most doctors agree that women who are pregnant should have medically assisted opioid therapy. That means at least temporarily replacing the drugs they are abusing with opioids that are more stable. Quitting opioids cold turkey is said to be dangerous for the baby and could increase the risk of preterm labor or even fetal death. Dr. Stephen Patrick is with Vanderbilt University School of Medicine in Tennessee. When I talked with him, he said the medical community really needs to focus on providing access to that medically assisted care for pregnant women.
I think it's time for us to reshape how we view addiction in the United States. It is a medical condition. It is not a moral failing.
I asked Dr. Jennifer Baylett at MetroHealth about why it's so challenging for women to find help. She was Hensley's obstetrician, and she runs the Moms Program at MetroHealth.
These are difficult patients, and they're complicated, and they have complex social needs. And many practitioners are just not equipped to deal with the depth and breadth of kinds of issues that they bring with them.
In the past few years, MetroHealth has become a go-to place for pregnant women in this part of Ohio, and they keep seeing more and more patients. The hospital treated about 5 pregnant women with opioid addiction in 2002. By last year, it saw 160 women.
What do they do for these women?
The hospital has a whole package of services before and after the baby is born. For Amanda, they started putting her on Subutex right away. They assigned her a social worker and set her up with intense outpatient therapy that was 3 days a week for 6 months. Even now, she still checks in with a doctor at the hospital once a month for her medications.
What about the baby, Valencia?
Valencia is gorgeous, and she's hitting all her milestones, like rolling over. Amanda and Terrell live together now with Valencia, and Terrell has really taken to being a dad.
That's very sweet.
When I last visited, they were very excited. The couple showed me their wedding band sets, and Amanda was going back to cosmetology school and doing well. And they were even talking about when they could bring Amanda's older son home to live with them.
Well, Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Renee.
Sarah Jane Tribble joins us as part of a reporting partnership with NPR, WCPN, and Kaiser Health News. Later today on All Things Considered, why tracking the numbers behind the opioid problem is such a struggle and a priority.
Support for your health comes from Novo Nordisk, working to support the hemophilia and rare bleeding disorders community through access to life-saving treatments. NovoNordisk.us. And from Athena Health, web-based EHR, revenue cycle management, and population health services. Athena Health, let doctors be doctors.
And this is NPR News.
Richmond, California suffered from gang violence. The police needed help.
Arresting and incarcerating people isn't going to solve the problem. I mean, it just isn't.
The city created the Office of Neighborhood Safety, intervening before gunfire breaks out.
We do something real simple that folks just don't realize how powerful it is. We love on our young.
Battling inner city violence, Monday on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune into All Things Considered at 3 this afternoon here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning, I'm Rachel Martin. Soccer fans who took in the friendly match between Spain and Romania this weekend needed some extra brain power to spot their favorite players, because the Romanian players had math equations on the backs of their training jerseys, the correct answers revealing the players' numbers. It's all part of an effort to get Romanian kids excited about math. No math skills needed to keep track of the score, though. That game ended in a 0-0 tie. It's Morning Edition.
It's 8:31 on this Monday morning. Thank you so much for being with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Still to come this hour, before you judge lazy coworkers, consider that they might serve a purpose. Just ahead, why lazy colleagues may not actually be slacking off after all. Hear that story in 15 minutes.
Support for WPR comes from the Milwaukee Symphony, celebrating Mozart with Symphonies 29 and 31, plus Tchaikovsky's Rococo Variations for cello and orchestra, this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Pabst Theater, mso.org.
Support comes from the Jazz Appreciation Month concert series at Fusion in downtown Kenosha. First up is the Lesser Lake Trio. Friday evening, April 1st, tickets are $8 for adults, $5 for seniors and students. More at KenoshaFusion.com.
Next time on I've Always Wondered.
So some people coupon for everything and they have like 400 hot sauces, and that's not how I like to operate, because I know when there's a limit, I guess you could say.
I'm Molly Wood. Who really benefits from coupons? Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tune into Marketplace at 6:30 tonight here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It will be partly cloudy this morning in Wisconsin, then clearing up as the day moves on. Highs will be near 50 degrees, except in the lower to mid-40s near Lake Superior. Tonight, clear, with lows dropping down to the lower to mid-20s, except near 30 degrees around Lake Michigan. For tomorrow, mostly sunny, then becoming mostly cloudy by the afternoon, with rain developing in the north overnight. Highs will be in the mid to upper 50s.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by scientists that has been used by 70 million people worldwide, with training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And from Frederica and Howard Stevenson, supporting Olin College, which is working to revolutionize engineering education globally to inspire the next generation of technical innovators needed to solve the world's challenges. Learn more at Olin.edu.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Rachel Martin. The terror attacks in Brussels last week killed at least 38 people, including the attackers. That's according to the Belgian Health Ministry. More than 300 were wounded. Many people are asking how this could have happened, since police presence in the Belgian capital had been high since the Paris attacks in November. And the chief suspect in those attacks, Salah Abdeslam, was arrested in the Brussels neighborhood of Molenbeek. Neighborhoods like Molenbeek have been seen as fertile recruiting grounds for radical Islamist groups. In part, many experts say, because Muslim communities haven't integrated into the mainstream European society. NPR's Melissa Block has been reporting in Molenbeek, which has come to be known as the jihadi capital of Europe.
It's just a quick walk from the center of Brussels, with its gilded towers and shops selling fine chocolates and lace, a walk across a canal that used to be the industrial heart of the city, and into a densely populated neighborhood lined with halal butchers and shops selling headscarves, hijabs. Molenbeek is a sprawling district, home to a large Muslim population, mostly of Moroccan descent. It was also home to a number of the terrorists responsible for last week's suicide bombings in Brussels and the November attacks in Paris. And this is where I've come to find an entrepreneur named Ibrahim Wasari.
I grew up in this house. It's the house of my father, so it's my area here, yeah.
Wasari is 37, a second-generation Belgian, his parents from Morocco. He grew up next to the Molenbeek City Hall, not far from where two of the Paris attackers also lived.
People think it's jihadi land here, you know? But it's really not like that. It's just some stupid people without a perspective for the future.
And that future can look bleak indeed. Parts of Molenbeek have a 50% unemployment rate. The Muslim community here is marginalized in ways large and small. Ibrahim Wasari takes me back to the canal, a symbolic psychological border between two divided communities. He recalls crossing this canal to go to the Brussels city center for the first time on his own when he was 16. And for the first time, he felt discrimination, felt like an outsider in his own country. In a cafe, someone told him, "You're not Belgian."
It's like you're not really a Belgian guy, you know? It's a little bit like schizophrenia, because in my mind, I feel like Belgian guy. The other guy, he tell me, "No, you're not." So what I am?
Ibrahim says his first name alone is an instant signal of identity. It even kept him from renting an apartment.
I give my name Ibrahim. The guy, he tell me no. It's not possible because we don't want Muslim.
ISIS recruiters have had an easy time finding foot soldiers in Molenbeek to join the fight. The recruiters feed on a population with few prospects for their future. Both Wasari and his colleague, Mourad Shahboun, know of young men from Molenbeek who have gone to fight in Syria. Shahboun tells me young professionals like him hope they can turn the Molenbeek narrative around.
My feeling is that we are 99% the same, and though we think that our 1% different will lead us to kill people, it's not the case. And definitely we try to change the perception on this.
I go to see Molenbeek's mayor, Françoise Schepmans, in her elegant chandeliered office.
When you hear Molenbeek described as a jihadi capital, how does that strike you?
It's false.
Absolument.
Absolutely false.
Oui, absolument faux.
But Schepmans does rattle off the names of the known terrorists from this neighborhood. Abdeslam, Abaoud, Abrini. A web, she says, of people who knew each other from childhood, became delinquents, were radicalized, or as she puts it, contaminated together.
C'est le chemin, voyou, truand, radicaux.
That's the path, she says. Thugs, gangsters, radicals, terrorism. Last fall, a month before the Paris terrorist attacks, Belgium's federal office that coordinates threat analysis sent Schepmans a list of 80 residents of Molenbeek suspected to be Islamic militants. Local police did an investigation, and I ask her, what happened then?
We transmitted that information to the federal police.
Mm-hmm. And then?
That's up to the federal police to take care of. Everyone has their role. Everyone has their responsibility.
And that illustrates a problem that many here are furious about. Dots that weren't connected before last Tuesday's attacks. Siloed intelligence information. A fractured government divided into many parts that simply don't communicate with each other. Melissa Bloch, NPR News, Brussels.
Here's some good news for new parents and their babies. Ear infections in infants are apparently on the decline. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein has the details.
Say the words ear infection to any parent, and you'll see the look of panic on their face. Tazanisha Midri of the University of Texas knows why. She's a pediatrician and sees lots of babies with ear infections.
They are very irritable, and they have fever, and they look pathetic, and they keep the parents up at night. And when they have to be taken to see the doctor, the parents will have to miss work.
So Shunmidri and her colleagues decided to take a look at what's happening with ear infections. They followed more than 300 newborns through their first year of life and found almost half got an ear infection by their first birthdays. That may sound like a lot, but it's actually a big drop since the 1980s and 90s. For example, the percentage of babies getting ear infections within the first 3 months is down by almost two-thirds.
It is good news for parents.
So why is this happening? Well, Shadmidri says one big reason is vaccines. The one for the flu that babies can now get. It also helps prevent ear infections. Ditto for what's become another routine childhood vaccination.
The vaccine that prevents so-called pneumococcal infections, which can, you know, cause both serious infection and also ear infection.
But that's not all. More women are breastfeeding.
Breastfeeding really plays a big role in protecting the infant from having both the common cold and from ear infection. Basically, the mother passes immunity to the infant through breast milk.
And there may be one more big factor. Cigarette smoking by parents and other adults is down, so fewer kids are being exposed to secondhand smoke. Rob Stein, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 8:41 on this Monday. Good morning, and thanks for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have the latest news coming up next from NPR and WPR, and then in 10 minutes on Marketplace Morning Report. The Oculus Rift starts arriving in stores today, but is the virtual reality industry ready to compete in the wider market? That plus all the morning's business news in 10 minutes.
My name is Clay Bonin. My wife Marilyn and I live in Door County. Our experience with public radio started 44 years ago when we got married. It amuses us, it informs us, and it enlightens us. We are saying thank you to WPR and our estate plan. For us, it is a simple matter of naming WPR in our wills. This seemed to be a good way to provide for others after we're gone.
For more information about including WPR in your estate plan, visit WPRlegacy.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Police raids are continuing today in Belgium following last week's terrorist bombings at the airport and a train station in Brussels. As Terry Schultz reports, the death toll is now up to 35 after more of the wounded died from their injuries.
Four Americans are now confirmed to have been killed in last week's suicide bombings at the airport and a metro station. Since then, Belgian authorities say four more people have died from their injuries. Belgian Health Minister Maggie de Blok says medical teams are doing all they can to help the victims. To the families, de Blok says in a tweet, courage, meaning stay strong.
ISIS claims responsibility for the bombings. They're down to the final four in the NCAA Men's Division I basketball tournament, Oklahoma, Villanova, North Carolina, and Syracuse. As Greg Eklund reports, Virginia was upset by Syracuse last night, 68-62 in the Midwest region.
By far, Syracuse is the biggest surprise with a number 10 seed. The Orangemen's credentials were questioned from the outset when the 68-team bracket was released. But the Orangemen earned their way into the Final Four by beating a number one seed, Virginia, in the regional final.
The Final Four will be squaring off in Houston with the championship game set for a week from tonight. On Wall Street, stocks are mixed this morning. At last check, the Dow was up 8 points. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. The Department of Labor has issued a new rule for industries with exposure to silica dust. It requires companies to reduce exposure levels through training, engineering, and protective equipment. The rule also cuts in half the amount of silica dust workers can be exposed to. President of the Wisconsin Industrial Sand Association, Marty Lehman, says they support most of the change.
The only thing that we're not in total support of is the reduction of the permissible exposure level. And the reason for that is a number of different studies has proven that the current permissible exposure level or the past permissible exposure level was protective of health.
Lehman says frac sand mines already use safety measures to limit silica exposure, but the rule could impact oil and gas companies who use the sand for drilling. All five remaining presidential candidates are scheduled to appear in Wisconsin in the next 2 days. Democrat Hillary Clinton has a late afternoon speech today at UW-Madison, events in Milwaukee tonight and tomorrow morning, and speeches tomorrow in La Crosse and Green Bay. Clinton's opponent, Bernie Sanders, spoke before a large Madison crowd on Saturday, and the Vermont senator is due back for appearances tomorrow in Appleton, West Allis, and Wednesday in Kenosha and Onalaska. On the Republican side, Ohio Governor John Kasich is campaigning in Madison and West Salem today and in Waukesha tomorrow. Senator Ted Cruz is due in Altoona this afternoon, and Donald Trump has an event in Janesville tomorrow. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Visit St. Petersburg Clearwater, presenting a new reality series that tells the behind-the-scenes stories of visitors and marine rescuers at Clearwater Marine Aquarium on Florida's Gulf Coast. Viewable at rescueclearwater.com. And from Barracuda Networks, offering cloud-connected security solutions for blocking cyber threats, including network intrusions, malicious websites, and application vulnerabilities. More information is available at barracuda.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Busy bees at work often resent their less industrious colleagues. You know the ones, shamelessly watching March Madness on their computers, making loud personal calls, taking two-hour coffee breaks. But rarely does one hear the slacker's defense. And we thought about getting it ourselves, but whatever, you know, we thought it would just be easier to ask NPR's Yuki Noguchi to do it for us instead.
Allison Lamb is a statistical clerk for a company in Fishers, Indiana. She says she usually keeps her nose to the grindstone, while her coworker keeps her nose to the cell phone, gabbing, texting, and gaming.
Sometimes people walk by and she's just sitting there laid back looking at her phone, so I don't think she's trying too hard to look like she's working.
Lamb complains to the boss and gripes to friends on Instagram and Twitter. Often, she ends up having to take on the woman's neglected work.
I've proven that I can do a lot, so I feel like if I slacked off, it would be noticed.
These kinds of scenarios occur throughout the animal kingdom, says Eisuke Hasegawa, a professor of agriculture at Hokkaido University in Japan. He studied the work habits of ants by painting the insects with brightly colored dots. At any given moment, he says, half of ants are basically doing nothing.
Even when observed over a long period of time, between 20 and 30% of ants don't do anything that you could call work.
You'd think colonies with lots of bums would not thrive. But Hasegawa's study, published last month in Nature, shows colonies with a significant percentage of do-nothing types are actually more resilient. They have a reserve workforce to replace dead or tired worker ants.
In the short term, lazy ants are inefficient. But in the long term, they are not.
He says the same can be said for humans. The analogy isn't perfect. It assumes that lazy people, like ants, can be coaxed into working. And Hasegawa acknowledges some people are just plain lazy. Pat Dolan says she learned a lesson about laziness decades ago in high school while working on an assembly line at a bookbinding company.
For me, it was boring. So I tried to make it a challenge. How many pages can I collect and how many books can I collect in an hour?
Dolan whizzed around until the foreman asked her to watch and learn from her slower colleagues.
I was 15, so I was pretty judgmental and thought, well, you know, that lady's really slow. She's just a poke. But, you know, she was very good at a different aspect of the job.
Dolan, a retired teacher and artist in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania, says she now values slowness, especially when it comes to writing. She says modern culture prizes more, faster all the time, but that isn't necessarily better.
The point is deeper thought, and you have to slow down for that.
The last place I expected to hear a defense of laziness was from David Allen. For decades, his book, Getting Things Done, has been a best-selling productivity manual. Allen champions a system where people get their to-do lists out of their heads as a way of focusing and being efficient.
The reason I discovered this is I'm probably the laziest guy I ever met.
Allen says many people confuse frantic energy with effectiveness. He argues some people are more effective on more sleep.
I sleep as long as I can. And I used to kind of make that a joke, but it's actually the truth. And then I discovered the cognitive scientist saying, that's going to make you smarter.
The person slacking off at work might be a genuine slacker or might be thinking through a complex problem. Glancing at someone won't always tell you how productive they are. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Never slacking off. This is NPR News.
It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and you've tuned in to Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us, and be sure to keep listening. The Marketplace Morning Report is coming up next, and then the music starts at 9. Today's highlights include a piece for bassoon and orchestra, the Foray Pavane, and a Heineken, a piece of music, not a beer. Join Stephanie Elkins for Morning Classics in 10 minutes, which is right after the Marketplace Morning Report, next here on WPR.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Kenosha's K-Tech School's annual gala will take place Saturday, April 16th at Mater Grano Marina Shores. The fundraiser features a meal, entertainment, and auctions. All proceeds will help fund an innovation lab. Visit ktech.kusd.edu.
Spectacular shows across the UW campus. WPR is proud to promote science activities for all ages. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
It will be partly cloudy this morning in Wisconsin, then clearing up. Highs will be near 50 degrees, except in the lower to mid-40s near Lake Superior. For tonight, clear, with lows dropping down to the lower to mid-20s, except near 30 degrees around Lake Michigan. For tomorrow, rain will be developing in the north overnight, highs in the 50s.
Support for WPR is provided by the Eduardo Neil Silva Young Artists Fund, in memory of his dedication to young performers. Eduardo Neil Silva was a respected educator at the University of Wisconsin and dedicated listener to WPR.
Support comes from Gateway, offering pathways to high in-demand IT jobs that include network security and software and web development, starting pay $50,000 to $70,000 a year. 1-800-247-7122. Choose option 2 and ask for a new student specialist.
A milestone today for virtual reality, plus a story about the harsh reality of paying for a place to live.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Koch Industries. Koch employs over 60,000 people nationwide. Learn more at kochind.com.
From Marketplace in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. In a few minutes, we have a report about real estate booms and the effect on homelessness. But first, there's word this morning that consumer spending went up just slightly in February, even as January's figure was revised downward slightly. For a check on consumers, now that winter has turned to spring, let's turn to market strategist Karen Cavanaugh at Voya Investment Management.
The consumer has actually been doing pretty well. And the reason why the consumer has been doing well is that the consumer has a job. The jobs market has been one of the best in 15 years. In addition, overall, the housing market has been steady as well. So while a lot of people are lamenting that the consumers aren't spending that much, they really are hanging in there.
And that's interesting here in 2016, because as we came out of 2015, there was some weakness. That was not a spectacular holiday shopping season that we had.
No, it wasn't. But still, overall, they've been plowing forward. If you take a look at year-over-year numbers, the consumer spending has been increasing. The consumer has been saving. They've been paying down their debts. They have higher health care bills. So it hasn't really translated into just retail sales.
And I'm glad you acknowledged those health care costs. The other thing is rents.
Right.
Because the housing market is tight in so many markets. Those are forces pushing the other way.
Some of that gas savings is going into health care, it's going into housing costs, it's going into rent. But overall, consumer is moving the economy forward. The consumer is 70% of the U.S. economy. So if they weren't out there spending, I think we'd be in deeper trouble than what we've seen. And the low GDP numbers would actually be a lot lower if it wasn't for the strength of the consumer.
Karen Cavanaugh, Senior Market Strategist at Voya Investment. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That report today also tracks inflation, which went down last month a sliver. Stock markets open now, and the Dow is up 16 points, 10%. Similar percentage rise for the S&P 500. The NASDAQ is down 0.2%. Easter Monday is a holiday in many parts of the world. In Europe, markets are closed. The most populous state is closer to getting the highest minimum wage in the country. There's news the California governor, Democrat Jerry Brown, has come out with his support of a $15 an hour minimum. It's $10 now. This would be worked out with the legislature and likely phased in over 5 or 6 years. Separately, a union-backed initiative to boost the minimum wage has qualified for the November ballot in California. After years of hype, the first Oculus Rift virtual reality headsets will start landing at the doorsteps of aficionados today. They go for $600 apiece, but the real costs are much higher, and that could fertilize what you might call a virtual reality economy, Nova Safo reports.
To use the Oculus Rift headset, you need a powerful computer, probably not one you already own, says Nathan Edwards of the tech blog The Wirecutter.
99% of the laptops on the market don't work, maybe even higher than that.
Oculus, which is owned by Facebook, is offering deals that include desktops for around $1,600. That's too pricey for the mainstream market, says Stephanie Yamas of Super Data Research.
We don't see a lot of adoption with non-gamers.
She says prices could eventually come down, but mass adoption won't happen until mobile devices can pack enough power for virtual reality.
There are quite a few hardware companies that are looking to be first movers in that market.
Like Samsung and Microsoft, software developers are also ramping up, and not just for games. Michael Pachter is with Wedbush Securities.
Every realtor will do 360 views of every house that they have for sale.
Within a few years, Pachter says virtual reality will be routine. In Chicago, I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by The Path, a new Hulu original series starring Aaron Paul, Michelle Monaghan, and Hugh Dancy. The Path takes audiences inside the mysterious world of a controversial cult-like movement. The Path series premiere Wednesday, March 30th, only on Hulu.
The main employment and unemployment reports for this month are due on Friday. Forecasters expect strongish job growth, with unemployment remaining under 5%. But among the things we'll be watching, the millions of workers who've dropped out of the labor force altogether. And among those, about 1.5 million prime-age men not working anymore and not looking. From the Marketplace desk at OPB, Mitchell Hartman has more.
A lot of these men, from their mid-20s to mid-50s, used to be their family's main wage earners. Caretaking now keeps some of them busy. According to the Labor Department, in the last decade, there's been a 30% increase in the number of middle-aged men who say they're not working because of family responsibilities.
I'm Anna. Elsa. Yeah.
These two little girls, age 2 and 5, are the day job of stay-at-home dad Jonah Sutton Morse. They were showing me their movie princess costumes via Skype. Sutton Morse is 33, a former business consultant living in suburban Chicago.
I would love to do it forever and ever and ever.
Sutton Morse's wife is a law firm lawyer, so they can afford this one-income life for a while, anyway.
It's both hard to find a job that would pay for childcare and for what I am doing for our family right now. And also, the longer I don't do that, the harder it becomes to go back to what I was doing or find something new to do.
According to the Labor Department, disability accounts for the biggest block of prime-age men not working now, many of them getting government benefits. Economist Peter Morisi at the University of Maryland argues some of these men, along with others who have simply become discouraged, could find work.
Indolence has become a problem with American men.
Morisi knows this opinion raises hackles outside conservative economic circles.
When I talk about this on the radio, I'll get emails from someone who'll say, well, you know, I was a vice president of a PR company. Do you really expect me to take a job at a Starbucks? My answer to that is yes.
Economist William Rogers at the Rutgers University Workforce Development Center insists it's not that simple. He volunteers for United Way.
I'm sure you can find me one person who, yeah, he's being lazy and fits that. But for the most part, people want to work. People want to contribute.
Rogers says what's holding many of them back is low wages in the jobs that are available and deteriorating skills as they stay out of the workforce longer and longer. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
And there are online registries for convicted sex offenders, right? Well, Utah has launched a registry that lists financial criminals, a first of its kind, apparently. If you missed that piece on the air, it's in the first Marketplace podcast of the day. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And you heard it on WPR, where there's news for you anytime you want it. Our next broadcast is at noon, and there's in-depth coverage on All Things Considered at 3, or you can find the news on demand with the free WPR app, or listen, read, and comment on stories at WPR.org.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Wasco Windows, Florentine Opera, and Wilmar Chocolates. You too can help ensure the future of WPR programs for years to come. Find out more at wpr.org/sponsor.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus. Honoring personal legacies in the circle of life, they believe that every detail counts and every memory matters. Piasecki Althaus is located in Kenosha on 39th Avenue, serving the community since 1931.
You're listening to WGTD HD,